the one that you like. You wind that coil on a piece of PVC tubing, and you make yourself a capacitor in series with it, and feed it correctly, and it will step up the impedance for you from 50 ohms to 1500. Let me drop. So now you can see the outer end of that dipole and the grounding system, the so-called counterpoise, because you're feeding such a high impedance. Doesn't have to be anything more than one single spike in the ground. It doesn't need a zillion ground plane radials, because you're feeding 1500 ohms, you're not feeding 37 ohms, which you'd have with a quarter wave ground plane. So that would be an extremely high performance antenna. He's now a silent key, but Mel, K2KEY, ran that kind of an antenna in Brooklyn, in Manhattan Beach area of Brooklyn, where he was living, in the evergreen tree out in front of his property on Dover Street, and it was an extremely high-performance antenna. Of some of the guys he talked to with that antenna, people thought he's running a California kilowatt, but sometimes he was running QRP. So as you can tell, lots of ways of feeding a dipole, and the nice thing about that pure vertical dipole is now you're radiating a pure vertical signal, which gives you a much lower angle of radiation, all 360 degrees around the compass. Let me drop. Now, even at VHF frequencies, as long as you're buying a high-quality Type N connector, Type N connectors, if you buy one with high quality, the fact that it's a right-angle connector, male on one side, female on the other side, does not matter. Yes, you can buy some really yucky Brand X Type N connectors that will have some extra loss to them. But with any reasonable brand name of Type N connector, that RF energy inside that coax cable, whether it goes straight down the cable or goes to a right angle connector that's properly built, it will not know the difference. Yes, your coax cable, you go to your manufacturer, he tells you what the radius of the bend has to be so you don't damage the cable. In a case of a piece of RG8U, I'm not sure what the exact number is, but probably a 4-inch radius bend is probably allowable, and maybe even a little bit less than that. So whether you bend the coax cable with a 4-inch radius, or whether you put a properly designed Type N right-angle connector in there, the choice is yours, Phil. All of them will work correctly, as long as you didn't buy Brand X. Kilo Delta 2, Kilo Sierra Bravo, K2RIW. You got it, Phil.
Well, Jeff, thank you very much, Dick. That answered both of my questions very thoroughly, and I am going to explore that vertical dipole. That sounds like a really interesting concept. I hadn't really thought about that. It sounds like it's almost set up like a J-pole, but you've got a full, I guess an eighth of a wavelength on each side of the dipole. So I'm not quite understanding that yet, but I won't ask you to explain it any further. You've given me enough to do some research, and with regard to the VHF setup, that sounds great too. I had a feeling that the right angle bend was going to be a problem, a direct right angle. That's what I have in the boat now, and it's RG58, and it's actually flashing over to my other radio, which is why I decided to replace the entire setup. And that explains it to have a, sort of a wide bend in the, I guess what it does is it spreads out the braid and allows some of the RF to blow through the braid shield. So, but again, thank you, Dick, for your very... 2KSB, back to the net.
Very fine, Phil. If I was buying coax cable from... Chile, and my buddy in Chile tells me that they make some extremely low-performance coaxial cable in Chile, which has about 45% braid coverage. And yes, the RF signal can leak out of there pretty easily. Particularly if you use RG14 double braided coax cable, and you end it with a 4-inch radius. You think you're spreading out the braid, you think the RF is going to leak out of there? No way. Even if you have ordinary RG8, RG58, you think you're bending it and you're spreading out the braid and your RF's going to leak out of there? Absolutely not. Now, that doesn't explain it. Whether or not your connector is well installed with proper grounding of all of the shield all the way around inside of the connector, that can create some leakage. Whenever you're putting in connectors, particularly on a boat, the biggest thing you got to worry about is can any water get in there. You got to
no droplets anything.
You got to weatherproof the living daylights out of it. What were you saying, Eric? If you actually calculate how much RF energy sneaks out of the braid of a coax cable because you've done a 4-inch radius bend, that would be a very difficult measurement to make. The amount of radiation would be extremely small. KE2EJ's got some comments on this. K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, K2RIW, K3J. I just wanted you to drop it for a second. You're picking up too fast. The gentleman that you were speaking to is on the eastern input, and because you picked it up so fast, it didn't recycle. You didn't hear half of what you said.
Okay, he didn't. He didn't hear. That would be a really frustrating question. But in the case of a half-wave dipole at 40 meters, for instance, it's around 66 feet long. You normally put an insulator in the center, 33 feet to the right, 33 feet. And at that point, take that same 67 feet half wavelength of your, do not put an insulator in the center against a tree, for instance, and feed the bottom, the outer end of a half wave dipole. Advantage of feeding the outer edge, as long as you're willing to live with a 15 your bow and arrow or your slingshot to put a piece of string up in the tree and hang a pure vertical half-wave dipole on your bands, and then seed it at the bottom, right at the ground, with nothing as a counterpoise but a spike in the ground. That's a very simple, quick operation, high-performance antenna. The few people who have done that say it's the best thing since the hot-baked bread, and people will say, why in the world hasn't somebody told me about this sooner? I think we've gone down the list of everyone who checked in. Let me stand by.
Yeah, tomorrow, I gotta squeeze another quick one in.
You got it, Joe.
Ivan? Wasn't coming on the radio, now I am. I don't know if anybody, a lot of the guys on here are HFers and I listen to different frequencies. Something I've heard on two different parts of two different bands. One was on 160 meters. I've heard on 1840 kilohertz, and I've also heard it higher up on 80 meters on like 3570, 3575. It's an air-modulated signal that has a series of tones which repeat in a certain pattern over so many seconds. I've heard this thing repeating itself. I don't hear like another signal coming back to it. I'm just not sure what kind of communication I'm listening to. Does anybody know about this, or anybody ever heard about this?
Okay, so it's a signal with a series of tones on 1850. Second harmonic, that would be 3900 or so. And you're also hearing it on 3675, I think you said. So a series of tones being transmitted on those frequencies. Does anybody know about it? If anybody does, give me your call letters right now, K2IW and the TechNet.
Yeah, it was 1840 kilohertz and about 3570, 3575. AM modulated, low-level audio, but it's definitely AM modulated.
Okay, and for people who are listening, does anybody know about these series of tones on those frequencies? 1840 kilohertz and 3575 kilohertz approximately. If you've heard those and you know something about it, give me your call letters right now. Of this group assembled here tonight, Joe, it looks like somebody does not recognize that. These are locally recognized it. And I was about to ask you the direction of arrival, which of course, what you did is you took your 1840 kilohertz three-element beam and you rotated it to find out the direction of arrival. Now, that's a joke, of course. By way of a direction-finding loop antenna, you might be able to find out the direction of arrival, Joe. W2LYY, K2LIW.
I don't have one of those built up. I wasn't that terribly curious to find out what direction it was coming from, just more of the content of what type of communications it actually was, being that I heard it on two different bands. I only heard it on 160 meters and 80 meters so far. I haven't heard it higher up in the bands. But the tones are specific in frequency. They seem to be, because I got a good ear, and it gets repeatability as far as the series of tones. They're very low as they're being repeated, like the tones are maybe half a second, three-quarters of a second in length, maybe about half a second, and it goes through a series of about maybe six, seven, eight different frequency tones in the repeated sequence. Kind of odd.
Satellite 2H.
Go right ahead, Lou.
Yeah, I wonder if it's the JT65. What you can do, Joe, is if you have an accurate clock, if it starts at the minute, you know, at the 0 second, it's probably JT65.
Lou, give us a couple words on that. JT65, Joe Taylor type tone communication. I thought most of those communications give a series of four tones in a very rapid sequence. Joe seems to be describing something that happens much slower. So is there a version of JT65 which it very slowly transmits that sequence of four tones? NY2H, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I haven't worked it for like 2 or 3 years, but as I recall, it went on for about 30 seconds or so. But the tip-off would be it starts exactly at the 0 second, because that's so coordinated. And, you know, it's multiple tones. I know he's got other modes, but the one that for HF usually
your recollection, how fast is the sequence of tones? Are you hearing beep, boop, 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 or is it beep, boop, boop? What did it sound like? How fast, Lou? NY2H, K2IW?
Yeah, it was closer to your second rendition.
Joe, when you heard those tones, how much time was there between the tones? Was it like my second rendition? Over to you, Joe.
Probably. You know what I'm going to do? Next time I hear it, I'm going to record it on a cassette recorder. I'll play it for you in the tech net next week if I happen to catch it during the week. So then you'll absolutely have an authentic reproduction to analyze.
To check the start time. Yep, you're gonna look at your start time compared to the WWV 0 minute indicator. On top of that, a 0 second indicator. On top of that, the tones that you heard that you said were very low amplitude modulation. Okay, I wouldn't think JT65 would be a very low amplitude modulation. I would have guessed it's carrier shift keying in order to make the tones. But maybe Lou knows more about that. Lou, JT65, is it really low amplitude modulation AM? Or do you hear the tones because you're listening in the single sideband mode and it's carrier shift keying? NY2H, K2RIW, if you happen to know, Lou.
NY2H. As I recall, again, we're going with your second. Trying to recall, because I was set up for digital. I worked the mode. And trying to remember if we were in sideband. Yeah, I definitely was not in AM. So I believe it's sideband. So I don't know if Joe was listening in sideband mode or not. If he's listening in AM mode, it's possible that they were beating against each other. I don't know, but I'm pretty sure it was sideband.
When you were listening to it, Joe, were you listening in the AM mode or the sideband mode? Over to you, Joe.
I first caught it in the radio, in LSB. I switched to AM. I went up to USB and didn't hear it or hear something there, but I couldn't discern what it was. And I went to AM and I could hear the tones clearly, but it sounded like about approximately like 30-40% modulation on the carrier. It was not high-level AM modulation.
Somewhere on those HF bands, when you go to the AM mode, your carrier shift keying will beat against some other signal, and you'll hear some low-level tones. So, we'll soon find out. You're going to be experimenting in the sideband mode as well as the AM mode when you make that recording during the week. We're now going to go over to the mailbag. And, are these guys going to try to stump us this week, John? KC2WGB, the mailbag maven, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yeah, we've got a few questions. Not too many. I think we've got two, maybe three. And I don't think too difficult. Let me let it drop, and I'll go on to the first one about a bird watt meter. Okay, it's good you were talking about connectors before, because this gentleman has a question. He has a bird watt meter. And he wonders about the adapters he has to use to fit different cables. He just doesn't have the money to buy the QC connectors, those quick change connectors for the bird, so he has SO239s on the bird itself, and he's using adapters to go to SMAs and N connectors and things like that. He's worried about the insertion loss and problems that they may be causing. And he'd like to know how much of the accuracy do you think it's affecting. He's working only with 2 meters of 440. That's basically where he's staying at. Nothing mentioned about HF at all. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
I think you can tune across the 20-meter band almost any day of the week. You'll find somebody with great authority telling you that each connector you use, each adapter, has got half a dB of loss. From time to time, you'll find somebody who's got a Mirage amplifier for 2 meters or 440, and he tells you that he replaced the SO239 connectors with UG58 Type N chassis mount connector. He thinks he picked up half a dB of insertion loss by each connector he changed. changed? Absolutely not. The only thing that has lost in the transmission line world is something that has lent. Your coaxial cable, which has got 100 feet of braid, 100 feet of semiconductor, and 100 feet of dielectric material, on 450 megacycles, RG8 has got something like 4.5 dB per 100 feet when the cable is brand spanking new. It's that length of copper for semiconductor, the length of copper for the braid, and the length of all that dielectric material. Put it all together, it's got 4.5 dB of loss. Your connectors, your adapters, rarely is your connector more than a half inch long electronically, internally. It doesn't have enough length to give you any loss. Unless you made that connector out of carbon granules, you couldn't give it loss. Let me drop. I will admit that if you buy brand X cables, made in somebody's sweatshop in Indonesia or somewhere, a really bad brand of connectors, you may be getting a flaky contact, which is not making contact all the time. You may be getting drastic change in diameters because of the way they fabricated it, where it gives you less than 50 ohms or more than 50 ohms of apparent impedance. But even there, it's only a half inch long. If you use the right equations, let me drop. If you use the right Smith chart adapting techniques, you can easily model what would happen if my 100 feet of cable going from my shack to the tower, 50 feet of it was 50 ohm coax and 50 feet of it was 70 ohm coax on a particular frequency. By way of certain equations or the Smith chart, you can model that condition and find out exactly what standing wave ratio you're going to get and what reflections you're going to get. So if you can do it with 50 feet and 50 feet of cable, can you do it with 50 feet of cable with a half inch of connector where the connector is 30 ohms? And by the way, the internal impedance of a UG, of a PL259, SO239, the internal impedance when they're mated is around 35 ohms. The magic of 35 ohms happens to be the impedance where you can handle the maximum amount of power in a coaxial cable system of a particular diameter. So, for a whole bunch of crazy reasons, a UH connector is a 35 ohm internal impedance. But it's only a half inch long. And even on 432, if you go to the article by K2RIW about impedance matching of connectors, which I think you'll find it in limarktechnet.com, and I think the article is also at amateurradio.tangovictor. In both cases, you'll find an article. Let me drop. In which I went through the mathematics, if you care, describing you step by step what happens when you put a 50 ohm coaxial cable with a 35 ohm connector in the middle of it somewhere. What impedance match to mismatch does it make? And the answer is very small. So, connectors and adapters don't give you any grief unless you bought brand X. So stop worrying about it. And the worst that a connector or adapter can give you is because it's an extremely poor diameter ratio, it can give you a reflection coefficient that's at 25 dB down, which is really the equivalent of a 1.1 standing wave ratio. It's not a, and if you now calculate what's the error in power forward and the error in power reverse because of a 1.1 standing wave ratio, instead of reading 100 watts, you're going to read 97 watts, if you know what I mean. A very small difference. Let me drop. As Joe was telling us earlier, our president of the club, when you hear things that you think shouldn't be there, please record on the input what amplitude you hear, and please make a report, as he indicated, of the interference you heard. So what I'm getting at is lots of guys are losing a lot of sleep over using adapters. 1, 2, 3, 4 adapters cascaded. They lose a whole lot of sleep thinking it's going to explode, it's going to lose a whole lot of power, and give them a whole lot of inaccuracy. As long as the connectors are reasonable in quality, and not brand X, you don't have to worry about adapters. They are lossless. Are you using real adapters and a real transmission line going up your tower? Let me drop. They do give you one very serious vulnerability. Weatherproofing. You got a bunch of adapters, even just one adapter. If you don't do a real good job of weatherproofing it, if water can crawl in there, even at HF frequencies as well as UHF frequencies, it can give you a lot of grief. But as long as you've done a good waterproofing job, I don't care how many connectors you've had to use. And by the way, I've got 50-ohm transmitters and I got 50-ohm antennas. Many of the cables going up my tower are 70-ohm hardline cables because the price was right. I got hundreds of feet of it given away free of charge by the cable TV company because they buy it in 5,000-foot reels. When there's a 150-foot lift at the end of the reel, they bring it back to the warehouse area and just store it in the yard, and you make a deal with the guy who's running that yard. They're not going to use it, and they'll sell it to you at some reasonable price. So you can get a whole lot of very high-performance, coaxial, hardline cable as long as you're willing to use 70 ohms. Let me drop. And what you could do is take a piece of paper tape, put the piece of paper tape alongside of the 70-ohm hardline cable, and write on there 50 ohms. Make sure that the transmitter sees that side of the tape. Make sure the antenna sees that side. Put the 70-ohm cable in between your transmitter and that antenna, and the system will work like a charm. you can calculate what loss you're going to get because of that. It's extremely minor. And because that cable is so much lower in loss than anything you can normally buy, if you're not going to spend $1 zillion and buy Andrew 7/8-inch airfield heliacs, that's about the only thing that's going to beat the insertion loss, if you know what I mean. Even though you're going to have a calculated 1 or 2 tenths of a dB of loss because of the impedance mismatch, because of the cable loss in dB per 100 feet is so much lower. I think a half-inch hardline is around 1.9 dB per 100 feet, whereas RG8 would be 4.5 dB. You come out way ahead, even using mismatched cable. So as I said, a good number of cables going up my tower are 70-ohm hardline. Let me drop. The bottom line of all this is if you know what you're doing, you can use crazy impedance-matched combinations of transmission lines and almost all connectors as long as they're reasonable in quality, and there's lots of ways you can measure that. If your connector looks good to your eye, and if it looks good to your ohm meter, there's a 98% chance it's going to give you no measurable amount of loss. There are people who used to think a PL259, SO239 has got half a dB of loss. I personally have put 700 watts to a pair of connectors in the middle of my transmission line. PL259, SO239, UHF connectors. A pair of them were in a transmission line going to an antenna. I ran key down 700 watts from a strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier for 10 solid minutes. At the end of that 10 minutes, that connector was slightly warm to the touch. Slightly warm to the touch probably is 1 or 2 watts of loss out of 700 watts. You calculate what that is, it's probably 0.002 dB of loss. So UHF connectors at 450 megacycles, there's a hell of a lot of guys who think it's got a zillion dB of loss. They're dead wrong. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, I don't think he has anything to worry about just like you, but it's a question of expense for him. So I think he's doing fine with the adapters. I don't think he would notice any difference. I don't think he could measure the difference if he put the proper adapters and instead of the 259s, put the ends on the meter. I don't think he'll see a difference at all. And I haven't noticed it in my lab, so I think he's fine. Okay, let me let it drop. I'll go on to the next science question from a youngster here, high school guy, KC2WGB. Dick, this young man has heard the discussion about the air pump and the heat that's generated when you're compressing air. Well, he understands that. What he's not understanding here is he notices that hydraulic jacks exhibit the same thing, elevation of temperature of the fluid. Well, it's not compressible. What's causing that? Maybe you could give him some help on that, Dick. KC2WGB, back to you.
Yeah, this, for those who haven't heard it, it's one of my often used examples. Why is the bottom of my bicycle pump running hot when I'm pumping up a tire? obvious. PV equals NRT tells you how much, doesn't tell you why, doesn't tell you how. Yes, you're applying a force to a distance, you're doing work, you're putting energy into the system, and it gets reflected into the air at the bottom of the pump of running hot. But in reality, the piston is hitting those air molecules. The air molecules are moving 500 meters per second before you start moving the handle of the pump at the air at room temperature. After you push the handle at a good rate down to the bottom, those air molecules at the bottom are now running close to 1,000 meters per second. They have picked up 500 meters per second of extra speed because of the movement of the piston. And the reason for that is the so-called ping-pong paddle effect that you guys have heard me describe before. And the ball bouncing off the ping-pong paddle comes out twice the speed of the paddle added to the speed of the ball. It's not obvious at first as to why that'll happen. And if that phenomenon wasn't happening, Babe Ruth would not have been able to hit that ball out of the park in Cleveland when he made his 500th home run. Let me drop. The physics of that situation was such that you take the speed of his bat, double it, add it to the speed of the ball coming out of that pitcher, and if the ball had perfect bounce characteristics, all of those three speeds added together was the speed of the ball that was heading for that outfield that went over that 40-foot fence 450 feet away and left that park, and that was his 500th home run in Cleveland way back in the 1920s, I think it was. Let me drop. But now a hydraulic pump pumping oil is a different phenomenon, slightly. If I take an incompressible fluid and I force it to go through a small orifice, that's part of what you're doing here, that orifice is giving you resistance. In other words, the rate at which you're trying to move oil through it, it doesn't want to go through that fast, and you're forcing it. Again, you're applying a force to a distance, and the oil is going to get hot. The mechanism by which it gets hot, at the molecular level, I don't have a good answer now. I know it does it, but at the molecular level, why do those molecules move faster? That's what your thermometer measures. How fast are the molecules moving? What's their average kinetic energy? That's what heat is. That's what a thermometer measures. Because you force them through a orifice, you've applied a greater force on one side than the other side, and they're resisting, they're experiencing resistance going through that orifice. That creates heat. And the mechanism by which it does it, I'm going to have to think about that. Don't have a good answer right now, John. Maybe we're going to go to that one next week. Guarantee there's ways we can research it on the internet. A smart person knows what he doesn't know. KC2WGB, I am sure. K2RIW in the tech net.
Very good, Dick. And the fact that it's going through a very small piston area and going into a larger area with that orifice restriction, you know, there's probably friction and other things, but maybe you could do a little research, and I think that was a very good question. KC2WGB. And that's it, Dick. There was only two questions for the mailbag tonight.
Hey, it's Jerry.
Yeah, I heard somebody say question, and now I'm hearing Eric. We're going to pick up Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
Now, I want to question you when you think about this, because if you take something that, under pressure, and you stick it through a little orifice, and you put it into an area that has less pressure, you get a cooling effect. So, when we're talking about hydraulic systems, there's a number of different kinds. So, there are those where there is actually no orifice, and the pump is a closed loop, and it's just simple one-to-one displacement. The types that do multiplying have orifices and additional chambers. So, but in that situation, of course, you have an equal pressure to what's on the other side of the pump, and when you pump it, you're increasing the pressure on one side. You have less pressure on the other side depending upon the load. But when you go from a higher pressure to a lower pressure, think about the kinetic properties of that. P2RIW, KA2J.
Yeah, many hydraulic systems are not using a piston pump. They're using a, what do you call it now? A cyclic scroll pump is one kind.
Centrifugal pump.
A gear pump. A gear pump has various mechanisms by which it could be creating some extra friction. But in the case of an incompressible fluid, a fairly incompressible fluid, like water or oil, if I've got the bottom of the pump completely closed off, and I suddenly apply pressure with the piston at the top, the fact that if I apply pressure means that the fluid pressure inside can come 5, 10, 15 times higher than it was before, that in itself does not create heat. Just making pressure on an incompressible fluid doesn't create heat. Forcing it through an orifice does. Allowing it to go to a lower pressure after the orifice on the right, on the other side, creates some cooling. I suspect that the heating is a little bit greater than the cooling, and I think that the net effect is a fluid slightly higher in temperature than it would ordinarily be. That's my guess on this. But just adding pressure to a fluid, let me drop. That in itself does not create the heat, but forcing it through the orifice does. So at the molecular level, what's happening in that orifice? We've got a bunch of molecules moving real fast through a small diameter channel. I guess they are bouncing against the side, sliding against the side. There's also a very complicated diagram of how fast the fluid is moving near the center of the flow versus the perimeter of the flow. There's a whole spectrum of fluid flow lines that are possible in that environment. And a lot of turbulence is going on there too. Helmholtz instability and whatever. So that slightly complicated situation at the molecular level, I believe. We're going to look more into this. Okay, you've got no other questions. You sure, John? Not even some that are left over from previous weeks? KC2WGB, K2IW, the TechNet.
Oh, Dick, it's been rather slow, but I just wanted to get those out. That one, I think, was a good one. At least it may have stumped us for a week anyway, but we'll get back to it.
Yeah, I wonder if it's related to what happens in the case of a microwave oven. I have come up with a theory that in my mind works. I haven't read an authoritative article traceable to the bureau that confirms it. I know that water molecules at room temperature are moving with an average speed of something like 600 meters per second. Water is doing that. I know that water is a dipole-like molecule. It's got two hydrogens and an oxygen. Common sense would lead you to believe you'd have HOH. In other words, a hydrogen molecule at 12 o'clock, another hydrogen molecule at 6 o'clock, and the oxygen molecule in between. You would think that's the way water assembles itself. It's good common sense. For a whole bunch of complicated reasons, it doesn't do that. You could say that one hydrogen molecule is at 12 o'clock and the other one's at 2 o'clock, and the oxygen molecule's in the middle. Why the two hydrogen molecules gather at one end, I'm not sure, but that effect makes the molecule bipolar. In other words, you put an electric field near it. I think it's the hydrogen end that's more positive, and the oxygen edge is more negative, and each individual water molecule rotates back and forth to follow each and every cycle, each and every half cycle of the RF wave created by your microwave oven at 2450 megahertz. Let me drop. So each water molecule is rotating back and forth. Each molecule has an average speed of 500 meters per second at room temperature. They're crashing into each other billions of times per second. Each and every water molecule is bumping into, I use the word bumping in quotes because they don't actually touch, they come very close, but they're essentially bumping into each other close to a billion times per second. But at the instant that they're bumping into each other, they're simultaneously rotating. So you've got this bumpy molecule rotating while they're hitting. Therefore, it's pretty easy for you to see the mechanism by which, at the instant they're hitting, they're bumping into each other, they're simultaneously rotating, and therefore those bumps on the side of the molecule are hitting the other molecule. The net result is that on average, these two molecules coming together, rotating and bumping, bounce away at a higher speed than they came together because of the rotation effect created by the microwave oven. In my opinion, that is the mechanism by which a microwave oven does almost all of its cooking. Let me drop it. The main thing your microwave oven is doing is it's heating all of the moisture in your food, all of the water. That's the main thing it's heating. You put an extremely dry piece of bread in your microwave oven with a glass of water. A glass of water's got to be there. You run the microwave oven full blast, 700 watts for 60 seconds. At the end of that time, the glass of water is coming close to boiling. Your dry piece of bread is sitting there ice cold. It does nothing. Put some water in that bread, moisten it, and boy, it'll get hot fast. So it's the water that you're heating in your microwave oven. And by the way, ice doesn't behave that way. That's why you put an ice cube in your microwave oven alongside a glass of water. The water will get hot and the ice cube will do nothing. You'll get a little bit of frost on the surface of the ice cube created by the water vapor coming off the glass of water that's being heated. Ice is a very different substance. It doesn't have freely floating water molecules bumping against each other and rotating. They're all locked together in that matrix called ice. So the majority of your microwave oven does is it heats the water, in my opinion, by that mechanism. I haven't read that anywhere in authoritative source. Various people will say, well, the water has a lost tangent of so-and-so. Yeah, that mathematically explains the heating mechanism. It doesn't tell you at the molecular level what's really happening. You read any of the good lectures, let me drop. Read any of the good lectures by Richard Feynman, one of the world's best physicists in theory. He worked on the Manhattan Project, among many other things. He tells you once you start studying as a scientist what's happening at the molecular level, you get a hell of a lot of the answers you don't get any other way. And you learn the material in a way that's easy to remember, but you've got a mental picture of what's happening, as opposed to just memorizing a whole bunch of equations, which doesn't do it. That's the main reason why that Don electromagnetic theory course taught in every one of our electrical engineering schools, fields and waves, microwave theory, Maxwell's equations, whatever they call it, it's a great big memorization of a bunch of matrix equations. The average student does not retain any of that material. They walked out of there saying, why the hell did I go to this course? I, for one, walked out of the class saying, I hate microwaves, I'm never going to work in that field. Boy, was I wrong. I got into the real world of RF at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, talked to real engineers, and I said, wow, why wasn't it taught to me this way? So, I think we've gone through all the questions for the time being on the mailbag. It's time to go over to the space report. Let me drop it. Paul WS2N, our space expert, possibly is going to tell us about this beautiful project where in August of 2011, a launch was made, and that spacecraft is going toward Jupiter. It's going to arrive at Jupiter in June of 2016, and that spacecraft is going to make a zillion measurements about Jupiter that have never been measured before. The spacecraft is going to go closer to Jupiter than anything has ever measured been. It's going to measure solar winds, magnetic fields, particles. It's going to be doing various radar experiments about the various levels of Jupiter. It's going to be measuring the mass concentrations. It's going to be measuring, I think it's about 10 or 15 separate experiments on that spacecraft. So possibly Paul's going to tell us about that one, among other things. So what's going on in space, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, after Paul, can we go back to the piston and the temperature exchange?
Yeah, I think we can. But Paul first. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, this is WS2N space. That report. Yeah, Dick, yeah, you're mentioning Juno. Yeah, we can talk about that, but a couple of other things to me are very important that happened this week. One of them was Friday. SpaceX launched CRS number 8. That's the commercial resupply service program. You know, they call it CRS number 8. The 8th contracted Dragon to be launched to the International Space Station with supplies up to 8,000, a little less than 8,000 pounds of stuff. And that's the one we've been talking about, that's bringing the beam up there. That's the inflatable module that's going to be attached to the space station. But one of the important things that SpaceX has been trying to do, now this was a successful launch, very successful launch, and in fact the beam now docked or burnt with the space station. One of the most important things that they've been trying to do is have a reusability system for all their equipment that goes up. They've been trying for a little over a year now. About four different flights. They've tried to recover the booster, and on those four flights, they've crashed onto the drone ship, the ASDS. They call them the Autonomous Spaceport Drone Ship that Elon Musk has been using to try to catch these things coming down from the sky. And this week, or this Friday, he succeeded at doing that. It was pretty incredible to, I got a chance to see it on the computer live when it happened. And it was really a very successful and very rewarding for that company, because they've tried it so many times. In the beginning when he started, he said there's going to be a half a dozen failures before we get it, and they did succeed. So here's this booster now sitting on top of this drone ship. The barge is about the size of a football field, and this booster is probably 155 feet tall, with four landing legs sticking out. Now they're going to bring this thing all the way back to the Cape like that. Very good. I don't know, did you see any of this on the news, Dick? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I think I read a report, Paul. Stop me if I'm wrong. On this particular mission, more than 7,000 pounds of payload by this Elon Musk vehicle was delivered to the International Space Station. The cargo ship container, I don't know if that stayed with the International Space Station or if that came back and burned up on reentry, but the booster that brought that payload up to the International Space Station, that booster came back and landed tail first on this barge and is therefore reusable, if I understand correctly. So how much of the hardware that blasted off came back? Was it almost all of it, or was it all of it except the payload container? But the main booster came all the way back home. Fantastic. That's my understanding, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, well, his goal is naturally 100% usability. He's managed for every flight so far to get the Dragon back from the International Space Station. Every time that comes back, he's had 7 or 8 flights that have come back successfully, on parachutes, bringing scientific supplies and equipment back from the International Space Station. And they land a couple of hundred miles off the coast of California. And he has his own ships and he picks them up. So that's been going on for quite a while, a good couple of years now. But he's been trying to bring the booster back, first of all. That's the biggest part. You know, it's, by the time it comes back, it doesn't have any fuel. It still has the 9 Merlin D engines attached to it, of course, and that's the heavy part of it. So when it does land on the ship, that at least the weight is down low, and his plan is to eventually someday, a couple of years, I'm sure down the road, he's planning on eventually bringing the second stage back. But in the meantime, since this is now a success, he's got plans on bringing back the fairings. The fairings are like about 7 meters long. And after a punch, protected aerodynamically, all the equipment, and when they pop off, they lose them into the ocean. He's experimented with trying to control the flight of those things back down. Let me drop it. And he plans on eventually catching them in the air with helicopters. That should be pretty interesting. And he saved millions of dollars. He's sparing them, of course, a couple of million dollars. The idea is to bring the cost down. Every one of these flights are, you know, anywhere between $60 and $100 million rockets that go up. And the fueling of it, I saw him on an interview, said around $200,000 to $300,000 in fuel. So, of course, now he's going to save on this booster. This booster now is planned on eventually being used again. He'll float it back to Cape Canaveral. He's going to take it, bring it out to 39A. That's a different launch pad from 40, where it was launched from, because 40 is going to be occupied by other rockets. He doesn't have the room to do what he wants to do with this booster. He'll bring it out to 39A and light the engines off again, not once, but about 10 different times. And once he's happy with that, clean them up, and he's going to put another brand new burst stage on it, because, of course, that doesn't come back. Not yet, anyway. And he'll use it for another flight. And there's companies, one in particular, SES, that, you know, they're a big satellite company. They're waiting online. They want to be the first one to use a reusable rocket. I guess that's very good PR if they can get that accomplished. So they're teaming up with SpaceX to do that. And I wouldn't be surprised if that doesn't happen in, you know, 3, 4, 5 months.
Paul, this launch, was it a two-stage rocket or a three-stage rocket that developed that delivered the 7,000 and some odd pounds of payload to the International Space Station? He's now getting the first stage to come all the way back home. He's talking about getting the second stage to come back home. Was it a two-stage booster or a three-stage booster that delivered the payload to the ISS? Back to you, Paul, K2LAW.
All the Falcon 9 rockets are two-stage boosters. The first stage, about 150, a little higher than 150 feet high. But that first stage has 9 Merlin D engines in it. And it probably produces a little over 1.5 million pounds of thrust. The second stage is another Merlin D engine, but it's vacuum rated. To be able to operate in a vacuum. And that has a longer cone, in fact, an even longer bell-shaped cone than it used to have. Another recent improvement. So it's a two-stage rocket, and then it separates from the Dragon. And, you got to see all this live. You got to see the Dragon separate. You could see the back, they call it the trunk. You could see the back of the Dragon. Inside, you could see the Bigelow beam. That's going to be attached to the space station. The beam stands for Bigelow Expandable Activity Module. And you could see it back there. And from there on, and it uses its own thrusters, the Dragon does, to get it to the ISS. This morning, I watched it. Morning with coffee. I turned the computer back on, and sure enough, they had the grappling of it, and eventually the berthing of it. Let me drop it. Now with that, when it was attached to the node, they call it, all these different nodes that are connected up there, they attached it to Harmony node. Three nodes. The first one that was put up is Unity. The second node, when I say node, these are big cylinders that you fly around inside. You live in these things. The astronauts do, and that was attached to the Earth-facing side of that one. There's a third node up there as well.
we have a cargo ship already attached, and that's called Cygnus, and that went up about about 2 weeks ago, and that also had a little less than 8,000 pounds of material, food, and supplies to drop it. And that's also on the Earth facing side. Now you have for the first time, you have a Cygnus up there, which is built by Orbital, ATK, that was launched on an Atlas V rocket. This one was launched by SpaceX on the Falcon 9, and now this one is also on a Earth facing side port, but now, you know, it's on a different node. The first one's on Unity, this one's on Harmony. Give it about 5 days, and they're going to let the temperatures equalize within inside the spacecraft, inside Dragon. And then they're going to use a grappling arm and reach into the back of his trunk. And they have a grappling fixture on beam, and they're going to pull that out with this Canadarm 2. That's a 57-foot arm that's attached to the space station they use all the time. WS2NFRID, and they'll pull it out from the European space station. One of the shots will move it out and connect it to the Harmony node, and that will be the aft or the rear facing port on. Not on Harmony, on Tranquility, on the Tranquility node. So that will be attached there, and then probably about 2-3 days later, they're going to start inflating this thing. That should be fun. So that's a very successful mission for NASA, for SpaceX. Back to you, Dick, and I got, you know, plenty of other topics here, but you want to... if anybody has any questions on beam or the landing of the booster. First successful one on a Cape Canaveral. That was a nighttime flight. Back to you, Dick.
I believe it was this week, Paul, that you mailed me pictures of the beam device, this inflatable module, which is all compacted as a cylinder ready for shipment. And then I think there was another picture you mailed me of what it looks like when it is fully inflated. And when it's fully inflated, it is a nearly spherical object with a docking port on at least one side, not two sides. And it looks like it's quite a bit smaller in volume than the modules that are up there now that it's going to be attached to. But I guess it is a more compact thing. You come out ahead in the volume of what you ship versus volume of what you get, but still it's a smaller volume. I am guessing that many of the modules that are up there now were originally launched by way of the cargo hold of a space shuttle, a very large volume deliverable system. Let me drop the quick. The cargo hold was made just big enough to contain the whole Hubble Space Telescope. Therefore, if these modules are about the size of a Hubble Space Telescope, they can be delivered with a shuttle. Oh, we don't have shuttle anymore. Were any of the full-size modules delivered by any other means than shuttle or pole? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, the Russian side had the Zarya. They're modules built by the Russians, and they have other ones as well, the Pyrrhus and the Rab-S. These are different modules that are connected on the Russian side. Some of them were bought up